Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
The time is August 480 BC. The place, Thermopylae, Greece. The occasion, a great battle. A vast army of Persians is on the march to conquer. A small force of Greeks was all that stood in their way. And yet, in a pass that narrows to a space smaller than a baseball diamond, the impossible almost happened. For 3 days, just over 7,000 Greeks, spearheaded by an elite unit of 300 Spartans, gave a savage beating to a Persian army that outnumbered them by a ratio of perhaps 20 to 1. About 150,000 men willing to die for the glory of the great king came up against the most efficient killing machine in history. Leonidas, son of Anaxandrides, king of Sparta, led the Greeks at Thermopylae. Xerxes, son of Darius, the great king of Persia, led the Persians. Thermopylae is no ordinary place, or rather, it was no ordinary place. The silting up of the land over the millennia leaves the ancient scenery hard to recognize today. Yet, what a landscape it was. It was a gateway region, a pass, actually three passes, containing the main road between northern and central Greece. Its name, Thermopylae, means hot gates. Hot because of the sulfur springs here. And gates rather than gate because of the three separate places where the land narrows. Thermopylae consists of a tapered plain that stretches for about 3.5 miles from east to west. Mountains lie to the south, and to the north is the sea, here known as the Gulf of Malis. Thermopylae is narrowest at its two ends, the so-called east and west gates, while the mountains are sharpest in the center of the pass, at the so-called middle gate. It was here, at the middle gate, that the Greeks defended the pass. They took advantage of a dilapidated old wall, which they rebuilt, and there they took their stand between the sheer cliffs and the sea. The land was less than 20 yards wide here in 480 BC. As far as the Greek defenders knew, the mountains were impassable. Thermopylae. It might be the most famous battle of ancient Greece, maybe of the ancient world. Its very name stands for heroic last stand. It's the prototype of many other last stands throughout history. For example, from Masada to Karbala, from Roncesvalles to the Alamo to Chapultepec, from Shirayama to Rock's Drift, and from Brest Fortress to Arnhem Bridge. The ancient Greeks first celebrated Thermopylae and turned it into a legend. Its continuing appeal is attested in such works as the best-selling novel Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield and the hit movie 300. So it's important to remember, Thermopylae was not a Greek victory. It was a Persian victory. It was a Greek defeat. In some ways, Thermopylae is comparable to Dunkirk, another legendary battle. It's famous in Britain, even though it was not a British victory. True, it was an unexpected deliverance. Having lost the Battle of France, the British expected the Germans to capture most or all of their expeditionary force. But it turned out that most of them were able to escape to England. No wonder they hailed it as a miracle at the time. Let's go back to Thermopylae. Glory and revenge brought the Persian king Xerxes there. The Greeks and Persians had been at war for more than a generation. Xerxes' father, Darius, had crushed a Greek revolt in western Anatolia, but his armies had been bruised by the Greeks in 498 and suffered a demeaning defeat at Marathon in 490, where a seaborne Persian army was stopped after landing less than 25 miles from the city of Athens. Now, the Persians sought to settle the score. Xerxes was bent on adding Greece by force to what was, without exaggeration, the greatest empire in the history of the world to that date. It extended from what is today Pakistan in the east, westward through Central and Western Asia to Macedonia in the north, and across the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt in the south. It took roughly 4,000 miles of roads to travel from one end of the empire to the other. The empire covered nearly 3 million square miles and contained perhaps as many as 20 million people. Geographically, it's about as big as the continental United States. Yet with an estimated total world population in 500 BC of only about 100 million people, Xerxes' empire held perhaps one-fifth of the people on the planet. Amazing to consider that maybe 20% of the people on Earth lived in the Persian Empire ruled by Xerxes. In comparison, Greece was tiny, covering an area of less than 50,000 square miles, much of it already in Xerxes' hands before Thermopylae. In June 480, the Persians had begun their march on Greece from the Hellespont. They commanded a huge army of about 150,000 combat soldiers and a massive fleet of about 1,200 warships. After passing through northern and central Greece, the plan was to head southward, capture and burn Athens, and drive into the Peloponnesus and destroy the enemy's resistance. In the end, Greece would become a Persian province. We shouldn't be surprised that the great king led the invasion of Greece in person. His name advertised heroism. Xerxes is Greek for the Persian Kshar-Yarshan, which means ruler of heroes. Tall and handsome, Xerxes looked the part. And he followed in the footsteps of Cyrus the Great, founder in 550 BC of his empire. Every king since Cyrus had led an invasion, and every king had conquered new territory. Xerxes had marched his army through the northern regions of Greece and past Mount Olympus into Thessaly. He marched into central Greece. Meanwhile, the Persian fleet sailed nearby along the coast. The army stopped at the pass of Thermopylae, which it found blocked by the Greeks. The navy stopped about 50 miles to the north at a place called Aphetai, opposite the Greek fleet at Artemisium. Xerxes hoped to win the war in central Greece. He planned for his army and navy to overwhelm the Greeks there through Persian numbers and Greek defections. But in late August, when the Persian army reached Thermopylae, the Greeks were ready for him. Only about 36 Greek city-states rallied to the cause of defense against Persia. Most of Greece either supported the invaders or sat on the sidelines. It's understandable. A huge threat such as Persia would frighten many people away. Besides, there were others who would think, why not join the greatest empire in the history of the world? But there were Greeks who resisted, and they knew that Greece had several things in its favor against the mighty Persian Empire. Among them, superb infantrymen, a competitive navy, brilliant strategists, and, at least in southern Greece, knowledge of the terrain. Further north, as at Thermopylae, the Allies' local intelligence was limited. But here's the question. Did the Greeks have the iron will needed to stand up to Persia? That was what Thermopylae would answer. Formal defense preparations began in spring 480, when members of the Greek alliance against Persia met to chart strategy. Their plan had three basic elements. First, since Persia would attack both by land and sea, the Greeks would respond with an army and a navy. The Peloponnesus in southern Greece would provide most of the infantrymen, since Athens would devote its manpower to its big navy. Second, since Persia was attacking Athens via northern Greece rather than by island hopping across the Aegean, the Allies would mount a forward defense in northern Greece. It was better to try to stop Persia there than at the gates of Athens. Third, time was on the Greek side. For political reasons, the Persian king wanted a quick victory, and for practical reasons, the Persian quartermasters could not supply their huge force for very long. So the Greeks had an incentive to drag out the war until the Persians gave up. In June or July, the Greeks sent an army of 10,000 men to hold the mountain pass known as the Vale of Tempe. It's in northern Greece, and it runs between Macedonia and Thessaly. The problem was they soon discovered that there were two other passes nearby, and it wasn't possible to close all three passes. The Greeks knew then that the Persians could get through, and so the Greeks withdrew southwards. It had been a failure of intelligence, a sign of how little they knew about their own country and how much darkness ancient strategists often worked in. Thermopylae was a better choice. King Leonidas reasoned that in its confines, a small number of men could hold off the Persians. Besides, Thermopylae was close enough to the harbor at Artemisium to allow a coordinated land-sea strategy. The Greek fleet would keep Persian reinforcements from arriving by sea and keep them from cutting off the Greek army holding the pass at Thermopylae. The Persians recognize that this is the Greek strategy, and so they coordinate their attack on Artemisium and on Thermopylae. They coordinate an attack both on land and at sea. Although they hadn't planned matters quite so precisely, the two battles, the land and sea battles, turned out to be fought on exactly the same 3 days in late August 480 BC. Okay, we've established all of this, but now we run up against a series of mysteries. The first mystery is numbers. The Greeks sent only a small force to Thermopylae. They had sent 10,000 men to Tempe a month or two before, but only about 7,000 to Thermopylae. If we look closer, the puzzle gets even worse. There were approximately 7,100 Greeks at Thermopylae. They were comprised of about 4,000 Peloponnesians from about a dozen different city-states, as well as about 3,100 men from central Greece. Besides 300 Spartans, some of the more noteworthy contributions were 400 men each from the great states of Thebes and Corinth. Yet they were each easily outstripped by 700 men from the tiny city-state of Thespiae. Sparta promised to send more men soon yet even so, the discrepancy in numbers is striking. Now, Corinth and Sparta each lies in the Peloponnese, a peninsula located several hundred miles south of Thermopylae, and which is protected by the natural barrier of the narrow and mountainous Isthmus of Corinth. No Peloponnesian state wanted to risk sending a large force off to central Greece without first dispatching a smaller force to test the waters. They were particularly concerned about Thebes, the largest and strongest central Greek state, and an uncertain ally because there were strong rumors circulating that Thebes was going to defect to Persia. Now, Thespiae was a very small state that was a neighbor of Thebes, and often in Greece, neighbors didn't get along. And in fact, Thespiae was a rival of Thebes. Since Thebes was considering defecting to Persia, Thespiae was determined to stop Persia, even though its location in central Greece put it directly in harm's way. So Thespiae made an all-out effort at Thermopylae, and that's why little Thespiae sent 700 men, more than Sparta did. Okay, the second question is just what Sparta's intentions were at Thermopylae. If Thermopylae was so far away and exposed to the enemy, why bother to risk even a small number of men, much less one of Sparta's two kings? Dual monarchy was an unusual but established part of Spartan government. There are good reasons to do this, both positive and negative. On the plus side, Thermopylae was too strong a position to give up. Successful forward defense might have kept war away from the Peloponnesian homeland, and Sparta had a reputation to maintain as Greece's leading power. The dispatch of a king symbolized Spartan resolve, even if he only had a few men with him. By his presence, Leonidas might stiffen the spines of wavering Greek states. Besides, the 300 Spartans were all full citizens, that is, elite soldiers, and therefore a scarce resource. In fact, they comprised about 4% of Sparta's elite military manpower, which is no small amount. So they too represented Sparta's grit and determination, and they could leverage success simply by bloodying Persia and slowing it down. A fight that caused casualties and delay would shake Persia's resolve while giving the Greeks a taste of Persian tactics, invaluable knowledge for use in the next battle. On the minus side, Sparta and other Greek cities faced a big religious prohibition. Two major festivals took place at the very time of the mustering of the Greek army, and they imposed strict limits on the dispatch of men to war. One of these festivals we've all heard of, it's called the Olympic Games. So that, said the Greeks, is why they could only send an advance force to Thermopylae. They promised that the main army would follow after the festivals. It's tempting to consider this a mere excuse, but it might just be true. The fact is that war tends to make people more, not less, religious. We all know the cliché, there are no atheists in foxholes. But what of the idea, first attested in ancient times, that Thermopylae was planned as a suicide mission? It's a great story, but it's probably a legend. Suicide missions were downright un-Spartan. Pragmatism and realism were the national character traits. Every Spartan soldier was an elite warrior. No Spartan would voluntarily sacrifice 300 such soldiers. A different picture emerges from the historian Herodotus, our best source on Thermopylae, a man who wrote approximately two generations after the battle. He reports that Leonidas handpicked his Spartans for the Thermopylae mission. They were, quote, the 300 men assigned him by law and whose lot it was to have sons. 300 was the standard number of Spartans used for hazardous assignments, but just what whose lot it was to have sons means is frankly unclear. In Sparta, men generally married around the age of 30, so soldiers with sons were probably in their 30s or 40s. Since the Olympic Games especially involved youth, men with sons might possibly have been exempt from religious obligations to attend, which makes them the logical option for the mission. But the choice of men with sons for this operation might also reflect military psychology, a matter on which the Spartans set great store. Leonidas, in particular, made a point of selecting soldiers with a shrewd eye. He insisted on choosing each of the 400 men in Thebes' contingent at Thermopylae, and he picked men of suspect loyalty as a test. His selection of an all-fathers unit of Spartans might similarly have served a psychological purpose, in this case, unit motivation. The Greeks believed that men with sons were especially mature and reliable, and so they would make highly motivated soldiers. There's no reason to think, as some scholars do, that Leonidas chose an all-fathers unit because he wanted to make sure that each soldier had an heir at home. And he wanted to do that because he knew that Thermopylae would be a suicide mission. In fact, Leonidas wanted to avoid unnecessary risk. Herodotus reports that when the Greeks reached Thermopylae and realized the huge size of the enemy army, they had second thoughts about the operation. In fact, it was only the anger of the local Greeks that kept Leonidas from supporting a proposed withdrawal southward to the Isthmus of Corinth. He agreed to stay at Thermopylae, but he sent messengers back home to hurry the reinforcements. And so a Greek army sat at Thermopylae and a Greek navy sat at Artemisium, and they each waited for the barbarian. Now, forgive me for using the term barbarian. The Persians were not barbarians. But that's the term that the Greeks sometimes used to call the Persians. The barbarian, if you will, was waiting in turn. For 4 days, Xerxes made no move against the enemy. No doubt he was hoping that the Greeks would retreat in fear. He had also discovered reasons to think twice before sending his men in to fight the Spartans. Now, a few months earlier, Xerxes had received a warning from one of the men at his court. He was no other than the exiled king of Sparta, a man named Demaratus. The Persians were very good at making their royal court a refuge for exiles who had lost in civil wars and civil conflict around the world, and the Spartan king was one of them. Now, they must have made an odd pair, the king of kings in his purple robes and gold jewelry, and the austere Spartan, raised in a country whose citizens slept on straw mats and allowed their sons only one cloak a year. Demaratus said that no matter how greatly they were outnumbered, the Spartans would fight. And the Spartans, he pointed out, were great warriors. They would obey the command of their law and fight to the death. That was a few months earlier. Now, on the eve of battle at Thermopylae, Demaratus was giving advice to the king again. This time he deciphered a strange report brought back from the Greek camp by a Persian spy on horseback. The spy had caught the Spartans outdoors, drawn up in lines, outside the rebuilt wall at the middle gate. But they were practicing maneuvers that left him baffled. While some of the Spartans exercised naked, others combed their hair. They combed their hair! Xerxes, too, found this behavior odd, but Demaratus explained that the Spartans were in the habit of grooming their hair before risking their lives. What the scout had seen, therefore, was a deadly sign of Spartan ferocity. No wonder Xerxes held his men back for 4 days. Why fight a battle when the enemy might be scared into retreating? And then, on the fifth day, Xerxes' patience finally wore out. He sent his soldiers against the Greeks. What was he facing? How did the two sides stack up? On one side, there stood a Greek army spearheaded by the Spartan soldier. With his bronze helmet, breastplate, and greaves, each Spartan seemed to be sheathed in metal. There was bronze, too, in the plating of his shield, which was large, circular, and convex in shape. A crimson-colored, sleeveless wool tunic extended from his waist to mid-thigh. The braids of his long hair ran out from under his helmet, while a horsehair plume swayed above it. The long hair, a Spartan trademark, was meant to look fearsome. Each Spartan was barefoot, itself a symbol of toughness. He carried a short iron sword and a long pike. The latter, which was his main weapon, was an ash wood spear, about 9 feet long, with an iron spearhead and a bronze butt spike. Arranged in close order in the phalanx, shields interlocking, the Spartans thrust at the enemy with their pikes. On the other side, there stood the infantrymen of Iran, men of Persia and the nearby region of Media, Persians and Medians. By comparison with the Spartans, they looked as if they were dressed for the parade ground rather than the battlefield. Each Iranian wore a brightly colored, sleeved, knee-length tunic, under which an iron-scaled breastplate protected the torso, but he wore neither helmet nor greaves, shin guards, that is. He wore either a felt hat or a turban on his head, while his lower body was covered either by a long draped robe or by a pair of trousers. He wore gold jewelry even into battle, a sign of contempt for the enemy, that Iranian soldiers felt so confident that they dared to wear gold jewelry into battle. They were confident they would bring it home. An Iranian soldier's feet was protected by shoes. His shield was smaller than a Greek's, and it was made of wicker rather than of wood and bronze plating. The Persian spear was much shorter than the Greek pike, which put the Iranians at a disadvantage against an enemy with a longer reach. Nor could the dagger carried by an Iranian outreach the Spartan sword. Unlike the Greek infantryman, the typical Iranian soldier carried a quiver full of cane arrows with bronze or iron points and a bow with its ends shaped like animal heads. Yet Persian arrows could do little damage against a wall of Greek shields or against a rapid charge by bronze-covered infantrymen. No wonder that a Spartan at Thermopylae is said to have quipped that he did not mind if the Persian's barrage of arrows was so thick that it blocked out the sun, since he preferred to fight in the shade. But equipment was only part of the story. Thermopylae was a battle of wits, and the Greeks got the better of it at first. Leonidas chose his terrain wisely and his tactics logically. Wave after wave of Persians could attack, but each would break on the long spears and the rugged training of the Greek infantrymen. The Persians' best troops, the so-called immortals, did no better than their less elite comrades when they were committed to the fight late in the first day. Spartan casualties were light, but Persian losses were huge. Xerxes had to concede that when it came to soldiers, he had, quote, many people, but few men. Or so Herodotus says, but kings do not give up illusions easily. Every Greek contingent took its turn in the line, except the Phocians, these were local people, who were posted on guard duty. But the Spartans stood out for their prowess. The Spartans had the only full-time army in Greece. Their training outpaced anything that the Greek king's men, or for that matter, that other Greeks had undergone. With the exception of the kings, every Spartan citizen was schooled in a rigid military education called simply the upbringing. Only trained and hardened Spartans could have carried out a maneuver like this at Thermopylae, turning and retreating in an orderly way, and then, once they had tricked the Persians into charging them with a roar, changing course in an instantaneous wheel, and crushing the enemy. Here's a version of the events by a man named Diodorus of Sicily, a Greek who lived almost 500 years later, but who had access to earlier accounts. I want to read it. The fight was a fierce one, and since the Persians had the king as witness of their valor and the Greeks kept in mind their liberty and were exhorted to the fray by Leonidas, it followed that the struggle was amazing. For since the men stood shoulder to shoulder in the fighting and the blows were struck in close combat, and since the lines were densely packed, for a considerable time the battle was equally balanced. But because the Greeks were superior in valor and in the great size of their shields, the Medes, the Iranians, gradually gave way, for many of them were slain and not a few wounded. The place of the Medes in battle was taken by other contingents in the great king's army, by the Kissians and Sacae, selected for their valor, who had been stationed to support them. And joining the struggle fresh as they were against men who were worn out, they withstood the hazard of battle for a short while, until they were slain and pressed upon by the soldiers of Leonidas, and they gave way. For the barbarians used small, round, or irregularly shaped shields, by which they enjoyed an advantage in open fields, since they were thus enabled to move more easily. But in narrow places they could not easily inflict wounds upon an enemy who were formed in close ranks and who had their entire bodies protected by large shields. Whereas they, being at a disadvantage because of the lightness of their protective armor, they received repeated wounds. So Diodorus of Sicily, and obviously there is a bit of Greek chauvinism there, a bit of ethnocentrism, less than fair to the enemy. And yet there are also some very valuable facts about the difference in equipment between the two sides and the disadvantages that the Persians found themselves in, particularly fighting in this very narrow space. Herodotus, to go back to him, he is a historian, and he lived in the generation after Thermopylae. He was actually about 5 years old at the time of the battle. He reports that Xerxes watched the fighting from a throne, and that he actually leapt up from his seat 3 times, struck with fear for his army. Again, we don't know if that story is true, but it's certainly a vivid detail. For 2 days, the slaughter continued. Then, on the 3rd day, the Persians deployed cunning. The Persians had always been not just brave warriors, but sophisticated warriors. Whenever they could, they fought the thinking man's battle. They had won victories before this way, and now they tried to do it again at Thermopylae. They outflanked the Greeks by taking a path over the mountains and around Thermopylae. The path would bring the Persians down to the sea again to the east of the Greeks at the middle gate, whom the Persians would thereby outflank. The Persians understood that treason was a relatively inexpensive force multiplier. They had found a convenient Greek trader at the naval battle of Lade in 494 off the Aegean coast of what is today Turkey. A Persian victory there put an end to the 5-year-long revolt of Greek cities along the coast. Persia had also worked with Athenian traders at the time of the Battle of Marathon and hoped to use them to open the city's gates. But the Athenian army put a stop to that. At Thermopylae, the Greek trader in question was a native of the region, a man named Ephialtes, son of Eurydamas of Trachis. In exchange for money, Ephialtes guided Xerxes' elite immortals over a steep, narrow, and hard-to-follow mountain track. They set out in the evening, quote, around the lighting of the lamps, end quote. That's what the sources say, and traveled by night. Meanwhile, Xerxes and most of the Persian army remained at sea level at the west end of the Thermopylae Pass. As the immortals approached the Greeks, a unit of 1,000 Phocian infantrymen stationed on the ridge above Thermopylae heard them coming. By dawn's first light, it was calm and windless, and the sound carried of soldiers' feet tramping on fallen leaves. Just imagine that sound. As soon as the Persians realized that the Greeks blocked their way, they worried over having stumbled into the much-feared Spartans. When they learned that they were in luck, that there weren't the Spartans in front of them, they drove the frightened Phocians off with a hail of arrows and continued downward towards Thermopylae. Meanwhile, the news came to the Greeks below at the middle gate. The intelligence arrived in stages. First, in a pre-dawn sacrifice, the Greek seer, Megistius of Acarnania, made out impending death in the victim's entrails. Then deserters, followed by lookouts, reached the Greek camp with solid news of the Persians' movement. The Greek commanders met, debated, disagreed, and most of their men started to drift off. Whether they were deserters or just soldiers doing their job is unclear. After the battle, some reports claim that Leonidas himself dismissed most of the Allied troops before the enemy could close off the far end of the pass. Herodotus, our historian, is inclined to agree. In the end, about 1,000 other Greeks remain with the Spartans, including the loyal Thespians and the untrustworthy Thebans. In fact, these Thebans were virtually hostages of the Spartans. What was Leonidas' strategy? That's not clear. Maybe he planned to have his men guard the rear and then escape at the last moment. But if that was the plan, it went wrong. Or maybe the king had decided to die. That's the interpretation which Herodotus strongly prefers, although he admits that this is controversial. The historian says that Leonidas had three reasons to have the Spartans stay: a sense of propriety, a desire to fulfill a prophecy that only the death of a king could save Sparta, and a thirst for glory, a primitive wish out of the pages of Homer and the Iliad. Leonidas gave the seer Megistius permission to leave, but Megistius stayed and instead sent away his son, who was his only child. At sunrise, back at the western end of the Thermopylae Pass, Xerxes poured wine, libations to the gods. Yet he waited until mid-morning to order the advance, in order to be sure that the immortals had enough time to come down from the mountains and into the eastern end of Thermopylae Pass. Always in ancient warfare, communications between any two points was always a question, often difficult and sometimes just a guess. Anyhow, at that point, any Greeks left at the middle gate would have been surrounded by the mortals at one end of the pass and Xerxes and his troops at the other. And then the Persian attack came. Instead of fighting from behind the defensive wall, this time the Greeks at the middle gate came out to close with the enemy. They battled fiercely, and they inflicted heavy casualties on the Persians. It was a fight to the finish. The Greeks first fought with their spears, and when all their spears were broken, they used their swords. And when their swords were gone, they went after the Persians with hands and teeth. When Leonidas finally fell, the Greeks drove the enemy off 4 times before recovering his body. It was a great gesture, but the Greeks were at last overwhelmed by Persian spears and arrows. But still, they managed to kill 2 of Xerxes' half-brothers, Abrocomes and Hyperonthes. Of the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, only 2 survived the battle. The other 298 died to the last man. The 2 survivors were, first of all, a man named Pantides, who had been sent off with a message to Greek allies nearby, and a man named Aristodamus, who was also a messenger, or in a different version, was one of 2 men excused for severe eye infections. As you can imagine, medicine in ancient armies was somewhat primitive. The other man excused for an eye infection, a man named Eurytus, is said to have gone into battle anyhow, led by his servant. Imagine that. Unable to see, but led by his servant or his slave, and went into battle anyhow. Back in Sparta, the messenger Pantides is said to have hanged himself in disgrace. And Aristodamus, the guy with the eye infection, was nicknamed Aristodamus the Coward until he redeemed himself in a later battle by fighting to the death. The 700 Thespians at Thermopylae died fighting with the Spartans. A man named Deinakes was honored as the bravest Spartan, and a man named Dithyrambus was honored as the bravest Thespian. The Thebans suffered only shame. As soon as the tide turned against the Greeks, they headed for the Persians. The Thebans stretched their hands out in a gesture of submission, and they called for their friendship to the Persians. A few Thebans were killed before the Persians realized that they truly meant to surrender. Xerxes accepted the Thebans as allies, but nevertheless, he had them branded on the forehead with the royal mark, beginning with their commander, a man named Leontiades. This royal mark was a sign that they were now slaves. Xerxes' men cleared the pass in the end, but it had been ugly and brutal. They were so angry at the price that the Greeks had inflicted on them that they mutilated Leonidas's body. They cut his head off and displayed it. Since the Persians normally took pride in treating their enemies with respect, this act in the pitiless Greek light of high summer was a reminder of Persian weakness. Normally, the Persians would not have insulted the body of a fallen foe like Leonidas unless he had enraged them by the force of his resistance. His head was a reminder that the butcher's bill for 3 days of killing 4,000 Greeks was 20,000 Persians. Any more such victories, and the Persians were ruined. The naval battles at Artemisium, which took place around the same time as the land battles at Thermopylae, proved even costlier for Persian. A combination of Greek boldness and disastrous weather, the gods of the winds, it was said, favored Greece, well, they reduced the Persian fleet nearly in half. The rump Persian navy of about 650 triremes still outnumbered the Greeks, who could not muster more than about 350 triremes. But the Greeks had the advantages of home water, short supply lines, and maritime expertise. At Thermopylae, Xerxes had stayed close enough to the fighting to inspire the men, but far away to limit his danger. Surrounded by royal guards, he sat on a high-backed throne. And, as mentioned, he supposedly jumped to his feet 3 times in horror at the mauling inflicted on his troops. Not that Xerxes' position was risk-free. Afterwards, the Greeks claimed that they had sent raiders into the Persian camp at night, and that those raiders penetrated even the royal tent before they were repelled. Story's improbable. It's so improbable that it might even be true, but we simply don't know. In any case, it's a reminder that real leaders take risks, and Xerxes was indeed a real leader. After the Battle of Thermopylae, he was a chastened leader. Xerxes summoned Demaratus again. Demaratus had been right. Sparta made a tough stand. So Xerxes asked him now for information and advice. How many more Spartans were they? And how might Persia defeat them? Demaratus might have been thrilled at these questions because they opened the door for revenge on the Spartan homeland that had sent him into exile. He told Xerxes that Sparta had 8,000 soldiers, all as good as the men who had fought at Thermopylae. In order to beat them, Demaratus advised the great king to change his strategy. Xerxes, he said, should force the Greeks to divide their armies by sending a seaborne force to attack Sparta's home territory, and thereby compelling the Spartan army to return home. This force, he said, would be carried by half the Persian fleet. The rest of the fleet would stay with the bulk of the Persian army in central Greece. These main Persian forces could defeat the rest of the Greeks. Well, Demaratus had a bold plan, but not a good one, because it would have allowed the outnumbered Greeks to even the odds and attack a divided Persian fleet at will and in 2 stages. Still, the Persians debated it in a furious discussion, and the plan was finally rejected. This was a key moment in the war. The Persian high command considered an alternate strategy but rejected it. Like most military decisions, the choice was made not on military grounds alone, but in the heat and dust of the political arena. One Spartan king had died trying to stop Persia's march southward, and another had put his life on the line in an endeavor to deflect it. Leonidas would be remembered as a Greek hero, Demaratus as a traitor, but neither won any more success in keeping Xerxes from his determined course. Whether it was the stubbornness of the great king or the will of the gods, the Persians would not be denied their appointment in Athens. One day, after his men had finally broken through at Thermopylae, Xerxes gave the order. The mighty force began to march, sail, and row its way south. All eyes now turned toward Athens, but they never quite lost their focus on Thermopylae. After Dunkirk in 1940, Churchill gave a speech in which he reminded his countrymen that, quote, "Wars are not won by evacuation." Likewise, a Spartan leader in 480 BC might have reminded his countrymen, and not just the Spartans, but all the Greeks who resisted Persia, that wars are not won by defeats. And yet, in the coming months of drudgery and blood, The sacrifices of the Greeks at the Middle Gate no doubt buoyed up the national spirit. Within less than a year, in great victories at sea at Salamis and on land at Plataea, the Greeks would smash the forces of the invader and drive the surviving Persians out. Afterwards, memorials were set up at Thermopylae for the dead, none with an epigram more memorable than this in John Dryden's translation. "Go tell the Spartans, thou who passeth by, that here, obedient to her laws, we lie." Thermopylae, an unforgettable battle. Thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to meeting you again next time when we turn to the great naval battle between the Greeks and the Persians at Salamis. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.